Live from the studios of Town Square Media in Northfield, it's Hurley in the Morning on WPG Talk Radio 95.1.
All right, now this is rarefied air. I have to somehow, for the next 30 minutes, the air is thin, because when you get the chairman of the Department of Cardiology to give you a half hour on the program, you know you're in for something very important. And I was having a nice conversation for about a minute or 90 seconds that we had with the distinguished Dr. Vincent Pompili from Deborah Heart and Lung Center. He is an interventional cardiologist and the chairman of the Department of Cardiology. We were talking about how this program, we have taken COVID-19 very, very seriously, because we should. It's the only way I could go about it. I mean, this is not something to take lightly at all. And especially now with this other variant, this other strain, and still some unknown about, you know, we hear what we hear, but obviously it's different, so it's not the same. So by definition, there's something to consider there. And they say, whoever they are, that it doesn't appear to be any more fatal than the first strain, but at the same time, something to be concerned about. Dr. Vincent Pompili is an interventional cardiologist and is board certified in both cardiovascular disease and interventional cardiology. Dr. Pompili earned his medical degree from Case Western University School of Medicine in Cleveland, Ohio. Boy, they do amazing work there. Some things that only happen in one or two places in the country happen right there. After medical school, he completed his residency in internal medicine at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. He also completed fellowship training in cardiovascular disease at the University of Michigan Medical School and interventional cardiology at the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota. He has a number of special interests, including structural heart disease, complex coronary artery disease, cardiogenic shock, and regenerative medicine. He has participated in many clinical research projects and authored numerous articles in peer-reviewed medical journals. And we have a lot to cover this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Vincent Pompili, interventional cardiologist and the chairman of the Department of Cardiology at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. And we'll be talking this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents about the after effects of COVID-19. I didn't get to tell the doctor. We've interviewed people that have recovered. We've interviewed people while they were sick and sadly didn't make it. We've been really just all over every aspect of this that we possibly can to try to impart important information so that people are careful and staying safe and staying healthy. So we'll be talking about the after effects. You don't hear about that. You hear these statistics. 99.9% in this age group, it's not fatal. But what you don't hear about are what happens to the people, though. In some cases, it's people leaving with an oxygen tank. It's not pretty in some cases. Dr. Pompili, Mr. Chairman, welcome to your program, sir.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. And Harry, I so much agree with you that this is such a serious issue that we all need to dedicate time to really educate and continue to learn. You know, we're coming up on the one-year anniversary soon of the induction of this virus into our country. We all could go through our journeys in our minds of where we thought this would be. None of us thought that we'd still be sitting here in January 2021. I'm still talking about the gravity of this illness and this pandemic. But here we are, so we have to educate and be as present as we can to understand how we go forward to get out of this.
Chairman, you are so correct about what you just said. I mean, we started 10 months ago, whenever it was, mid-March of last year, with a two-week project of flattening the curve. Look at us now. So, yeah, we had no idea. And thankfully, amazingly, the vaccines, I think, are the game changer where we go from pandemic to endemic. But let me ask you, tell your listeners, Mr. Chairman, they hear me talk all the time. You're the expert. Tell us some of the long-term symptoms that patients are experiencing from COVID-19, because this rarely is talked about. When I see these statistics, how many people recover, but go out and do your homework and interview people that are on oxygen or have brain issues or clots or heart things. I mean, this is more than just that statistic that would lead to a false I think, a sense of comfort that there's nothing here, you know, unless you're the 0.01 unlucky one. What are the long-term symptoms that you've been seeing?
No, great question, Harry. And what we've learned about this virus is that, yeah, one size does not fit all, unfortunately. And you're spot on. I hear that same concern. Oh, 99% of people get well. I'll get my COVID and move on and recover and be immune and it's all good. That's a naive and probably I have to hold my tongue inappropriate way to approach this virus. The long-term effects to begin with are still unknown to begin with, you know, but we are continuing to learn from them. Obviously, you may have talked on this show, we all know the acute effects are quite variable from someone having just a low-grade fever to actually being asymptomatic to those who just have muscle aches and headaches to the severe complications that we know about with pulmonary infection, COVID pneumonia on ventilators or on ECMO, which is heart-lung support, and to the extreme. So beyond the acute phases, you know, the long-term effects have been real. Some of them that we see and we've talked to patients about include probably the most common thing is their first presentation, profound fatigue for months afterwards. Others still have that have severe lung damage will have severe shortness of breath. And you're right, we are actually here at DeBoer Heart and Lung Center opening up a post-COVID pulmonary clinic specifically to meet the needs here in South Jersey of the number of patients who have suffered COVID pneumonia and have long-term chronic lung issues afterwards, including pulmonary fibrosis, requiring oxygen for long periods of time. That is probably a large one, especially for those who have had COVID pneumonia. Other things we find, people have chronic cough for months afterwards, they have chest pain, they have myalgias, muscle aches. The loss of taste and smell, and you probably talked about on this, is one of the signature findings of people with COVID infection. Many times that recovers. Other people have lost their taste and smell for up to 6 months, and others even have developed a noxious stimulus sensation. So when they taste or smell something sweet or salty or savory, it actually smells more like rotten garbage, and that may go on also. So the variety of the symptoms that are out there that are persistent are pretty pronounced, quite honestly.
Wild card question. Do we have any idea yet? I know there's just so much, as you said, Mr. Chairman, just a moment ago, that we don't know, but some people seemingly are just completely asymptomatic. I still say to people, there could be stuff going on that you don't know about, but we'll just go with the company line that some people are almost unaffected by it, and then it crushes yep. and kills other people. How can that be?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is we don't completely know. A couple of hypotheses that will be out there, and we'll talk. I think we're going to talk a little bit later on about sort of what are the risk factors for those who really do get sick. But even then, every now and then you have a random 25-year-old that's on a ventilator, a respirator in the hospital with it. So how can it be? I do think that there is something related to a dose response. You know, the amount of inoculant, the amount of virus that you inhale. With an exposure is variable, and I think that is one that has been kind of discussed and proven. So if you are like living in close quarters with someone with COVID pneumonia for 3 days and sort of the dose of the virus that gets into your system is high, I think there's a higher chance that you're going to develop more of a serious infection versus someone who may have a low dose transient exposure. They may have some colonization of the virus in their nose, and that could be that. Aside from that, you know, the other house can be really, we know the risk factors. You know, the people that seem to get sick are clearly those who are older, over 65, obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes, smokers, chronic illness. We know their immune systems are compromised, and for all those specific reasons, and they don't develop the same immune response to come on to the virus and really make the attacks that are necessary. So it is unknown. I think that is obviously the risk factors of those types of patients we talked about are part of it, but I also think it's how much virus you sort of suck in, basically.
You are listening to the distinguished Dr. Vincent Pompili, interventional cardiologist and the chairman of the Department of Cardiology at DeBoer Heart and Lung Center. The program is DeBoer Heart and Lung Center Presents, and Dr. Is speaking this half hour, about the after effects of COVID-19. Dr. Pompili, you mentioned a little bit ago about some of this is cardiac in nature, which I think begs the question, how does a virus that is primarily respiratory in nature affect the heart?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's although most of the patients present with respiratory or pulmonary lung involvement is the most severe effect, COVID infection is systemic. It affects all parts of your body. And it also can hone to the heart or drive directly to the heart. Interesting early study, I don't know if you had followed or talked to this on the show before, and this was from where I worked for many years on faculty at Ohio State University. This data came out. And it also was an effect that really led to some of the rules for the football players. In the spring and summer of this past year, all the athletes that had developed even asymptomatic COVID infection, and they were testing all of them on a regular basis, underwent a cardiac MRI, so basically a magnetic resonance imaging study of the heart, with a very specialized tool using gadolinium, which is kind of a way to kind of tag inflammation in the heart. And what they had found with that study, and this is Dr. Daniels, one of my former colleagues, 30% of the asymptomatic athletes in this study had evidence of involvement in their heart.
Wow.
So it was basically inflammation. That raised an early red flag, especially in the arena of, you know, football, and I think that's why the Big Ten was a little slow on that. In questioning, does this inflammation, will it lead to long-term sequelae or complications of the heart? The answer is still unknown, but anytime we have any type of inflammation or scarring in the heart, that is something that worries us as cardiologists. Is scar tissue in the heart specifically is an area which can be a nidus or a spot where a dangerous arrhythmia can form. If the inflammation and scarring comes so severe, you can actually develop a cardiomyopathy or a weakened heart muscle and lead to congestive heart failure. So the sequelae that is the most worrisome in the heart is those patients that are even asymptomatic can develop that. So that's one worry. And then to expand on the question, there are also some very unfortunate individuals who have severe systemic COVID infection that developed severe cardiomyopathy and weakening of the heart muscle, almost what we call myocarditis, or an inflammation of the viral infection to the heart, and they develop severe weakened heart muscles.
Do we know what what the throwing of the clots that's happening as well, what that's all about?
Yeah, that's another way that the cardiovascular system is absolutely affected. What happens with COVID infection, this is another reason many young people have died from this, is that the virus has an effect on causing your body to become hypercoagulable, actually the blood clots to form more easily. It affects the COVID virus, it infects the activity of the platelets specifically, and will cause individuals to, during the acute infection phase, to develop, you know, the ability to create clot too quickly and inappropriately, and then those clots can migrate or flow from wherever they are formed, in your leg or your arm, and go into the lungs and cause pulmonary embolism if it's on the venous side, or they can go up to the brain or the heart and cause heart attack or a stroke, and those are very serious effects. And we have, you know, in our therapies over time have realized early on that this was an issue, especially those with acute or severe COVID infection, and we have treated those patients with blood thinners such as heparin or anticoagulation for a period of time afterwards. But it's really just creating a propensity towards worsening of clot formation in your body.
We only take one break. I don't even want to take a break. I want to thank my program director for making it the shortest break of the program today. So we're blessed with that. You are listening to a passionate nurse dad, that would be me, with a very distinguished chairman of the Department of Cardiology for Deborah Heart and Lung Center, Chairman Pompili, talking about a topic that we don't hear enough about. We hear how many have tested positive. We hear reports on how many have resolved. And we hear things about the numbers of deaths. But you rarely hear an in-depth discussion about the after effects of COVID-19. What an important program today on Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Chairman Pompili, all about the after effects of COVID-19. To reach Deborah at any time, if you prefer digitally, it's very simple. Any digital device, demanddebora.org, or if you prefer to call, it's easy to do as well, and then you'll be prompted right to scheduling, 866-226-3238, 866-226-3238, or demanddebora.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes with the chairman. I am respectfully yours.
Hurley in the Morning, WPG Talk Radio, 95.5 FM and 1450 AM. South Jersey's most listened to morning talk show on South Jersey's number one rated talk station. Hurley in the Morning on WPG Talk Radio 95.5 and the WPG Talk Radio app.
And thank you to our great listeners for making that possible. We it's all because of you, and we know it. Chairman Pompili continues this very important episode of Debora Heart and Lung Center Presents, the wide-ranging discussion about the after effects of COVID-19. Chairman, you mentioned a little earlier in your program some of the comorbidities. If there are any more that you want to address, the time is yours right now, but I want to expand the question into the area of how important is it for patients that have the comorbidities to really stay on top of things, keeping their doctor's appointments and so on.
Absolutely. Yeah. Early on, and it's continued to, unfortunately, be a consistent message that we see these patients, those with the comorbidities are clearly at the highest risk. The one we can't change is our age, of course. You know, so as you get older, for all of us, that's our reality. But as we age, and clearly those individuals over 65 and then beyond are the highest risk. But the other areas that are critical, including, you know, those with hypertension, diabetes, those who are smokers, those who the BMI is greater than 30, so it's moderate to severe obesity, are all in the categories of the highest comorbidities. So what we do know across the board, regardless of COVID, but as important with COVID, is managing those comorbidities best we can in terms of exercise, weight loss, controlling your blood pressure, controlling your diabetes are critical, taking your medications. And unfortunately, even though these are the most vulnerable patients, as we kind of have learned and we're going to talk about here, these are the patients that for a number of reasons have stayed away from their physicians. And I can assure you, even at Debora, when I go into my ambulatory outpatient clinic, you know, I'm seeing patients that I've not routinely seen on a regular basis that have deferred their care for a while. And it's and that has led to bad consequences, poorly controlled blood pressure, significant weight gain, diabetes out of control that was in better control. And I think that we've just become distracted and fearful. And the irony is that these patients make themselves even more vulnerable for developing severe COVID illness.
It's so cruel. It's another detriment to the COVID-19 disease, because if you, out of fear for going to a regular doctor's appointment, if you're not taking care of yourself for now almost a year, there's going to be a pileup of issues that when this is all over, there's going to be a lot to deal with, isn't there, doctor?
That's correct, and that's correct. And I think early on, as we kind of opened up our conversation, we all thought that this is going to pass over by June. So yeah, no big deal. Let me defer my visit with Dr. Pompili till, you know, June. Not a big deal. And maybe if that, we all kind of naively thought that was the truth. This is going to be with us for a while, so we cannot go on and deferring that. I think that what all the listeners and all my patients, all our patients collectively have to know is that we have really created very, very safe environments for patients to be seen, both in the ambulatory clinics and throughout the hospital. Our screening processes and techniques for patients coming in are significant. All of our healthcare providers, we'll talk about this within days, will be fully vaccinated, as those who need or can be. And I think that the hospital and the medical clinics are becoming much safer places than going to Walmart or to Target or to Wegmans than coming to see us.
Where, by the way, people seem to go freely, even though probably
they
the transmission do. Rate is much more a reality. So in terms of overcoming right. objections, I think you just did, but to make it interesting and to further the topic, in terms of those that are having fears of keeping appointments, what are the safety precautions that you're doing to have patients feel safe?
Many, and this has been not just here at DeBoer, but I think all the health facilities throughout the country, and certainly in New Jersey, have. Obviously, we screen all patients with temperatures as they come in the door. The entire facility is mask mandatory, both all employees, all nurses, all staff members, all physicians, and all patients are required. We've minimized the contact in the waiting room, so there are very essentially, you wait in your car till you get a text, and you come in for your visit. We've also really reduced the number of visitors, only for patients really in grave illness. We do not allow visitors into the hospital. So really, it's a direct patient care model. Aside from that, patients that come into the hospital for elective procedures, such as a catheterization or a stent or an arrhythmia study, electrophysiology study, we perform COVID testing on those patients 72 hours prior to their arriving and making sure that they're COVID negative. Understanding it's only one point in time, as we know, and they still may be a carrier upon that, but that has been an effective screening tool. So overall, I think in January 2021, I could confidently argue that a hospital is a safe place to be. It's not zero, but the incidence of developing or acquiring COVID infection in the hospital is probably one of the lowest out there right now.
I'll just say unhelpful, undignified things went on that I think were very detrimental. You know where I'm going. That were very detrimental to a really uplifting, positive launch of the vaccine. Because honestly, and I feel so passionate about this, it's a triumph. To get a vaccine, I understand the RNA technology was in the works for like a decade, but in a perfect storm, to get a vaccine going that is usually in the history of the world been at least a 4 or 5 year or more situation. And as you know, in some cases, there aren't vaccines ever achieved, like HIV and some things like that.
Correct.
So it's treatable but not curable. This vaccine, to me, is amazing. It gives us our lives back. It takes the boot off of the throat of our economy. Everybody should be thrilled about it. But of course, when people say unhelpful things, it got off to a bad start. The good news is, Chairman, that it's on a rally right now and it's rebounded. And I know the numbers that I have heard that we need something like at least 70% of the American people to take the vaccine so that we get that herd immunity or whatever it's called. How, in your estimation, Chairman Pompili, is the vaccine going?
Yes. I think to echo your initial statements about the mRNA and all the vaccines, we have developed as a country and as with partnership with industry and government this vaccine in record time, and it is and was necessary to do it in that fashion. And it also, as you inferred, is there are a number of sound bites out there, as we all have heard, that really are negative spots, but this is too rapid, it's not safe. The technology and the development of the mRNA vaccine specifically has been in process and development for over a decade. The customization of that vaccine to a specific virus is what really was the work that was done in preparation for that vaccine to go forward. So where are the hurdles? I mean, obviously distribution is one. And it was disappointing with the launch in December that there was more vaccine out there than distributed. I had heard different numbers in different states that really only 20% of the vaccine that was supposed to be given to the patients, to healthcare workers and to high-risk patients was actually distributed. I think that kind of had to do with a little bit of a bumpy start. It had to do, I think, with the holidays and several issues around there. But that being said, I think that we are preparing to ramp up. And I've heard and read from government that the plans to really accelerate ongoing development so that vaccine will be better available for the second booster shot is going to happen, so we're not withholding the first vaccine. I think the biggest answer to all of the listeners and to all of our patients out there is that this is a safe vaccine. It really stimulates our immune system. It's a way to really creatively generate a protein, an antigen, if you will, in your system that the body will know is foreign. You know, in some not too much detail, usually we give an attenuated or a dead virus. We actually give a piece of the virus in the vaccine, like the polio virus vaccine, and that's what we kind of stimulate the same process. This is a much more sophisticated pathway where we actually develop the mRNA, which is the code to create just the one protein on the crown of the virus. We fool your cells to take that up. They produce that protein, they release it, and then your immune system, which is highly talented and very intricate, creates a memory and a reaction to that virus. So it is very safe. The mRNA, which is a very safe piece of DNA, goes away. It goes away. It doesn't get integrated into your system. It doesn't cause cancer or anything else. It really just does the same thing that all vaccines do.
For those who wonder, and again, this is about overcoming objections so that people feel confident when they speak with their doctor that this is right for them to be inoculated as soon as possible, as soon as they're in a group that is able to get the vaccine. Because I've been encouraging people, talk to your doctor, of course, but the vaccine is, I think, going to be the difference maker with dealing with this. I mean, I just heard the Moderna CEO say that that COVID-19 is going to be around forever. It's never going to be gone. So, I mean, if it's something that's going to be around, I'm a big believer in the flu shot every year. I take it. I never missed. Haven't had the flu in decades. I'm a believer in that. I'm a believer in this. But for those who hear, wait a minute now, the first one, the first shot seems to go well, but then if 28 days later I get the second shot and then I don't feel good for like a day or something, explain, that's a good thing. That's your body doing something wonderful, yeah. But explain.
Absolutely. And I can explain, and I've just lived through that myself. I can give you real-time effects on that. So with all vaccines, in order for them to be working, you have to generate an immune response. What's just an important primer is that to understand about all viral infections in general, it's not the virus which makes you feel sick. It's your body's over-immune response to the immune cells, the white blood cells that are stimulated that produce these bad things that float through that make you develop a fever and aches, muscles, or lung issues. With the COVID vaccine, yes, it is correct. With the mRNA one specifically, after the first vaccination at day one, you probably for the first 40 hours, you know, less than 10% of people feel something, maybe a low-grade fever, you know, an arm ache or something to that effect. Some very rarely, and maybe just be some of the constituents of the vaccine, do develop an allergic reaction, and that's why we monitor all patients after receiving the vaccine. And if the allergic reaction happens, it happens quickly and can be addressed in the facility where the vaccine is delivered. You're spot on. The second vaccine, you know, up to 60% of patients do feel something with it, and that's actually a good thing. As you had said, you've already developed some level of immunity from the first vaccination. Your body and the memory of your white blood cells is now present. That they see, if they see this antigen, this protein come back in the system, they're going to react to it, and that's a good thing, and that's what happens. So essentially with the second vaccine, it's a little more common for a day to 3 days afterwards to feel like you're having the flu. You may develop symptoms of muscle aches, shortness of breath. You may feel symptoms of a low-grade fever. And those actually, as you inferred, are actually good things. And when I received my second vaccine last Thursday, I felt like on by Friday and Saturday I had the flu. And honestly, I had a low-grade fever, a little achy and sore. I took Tylenol. By Sunday morning, I was back to myself. And so when people tell me that, I say, hey, that's a good thing. So don't make that the reason not to get the vaccine.
I know you have to run. If we could squeeze this in, Chairman, because I think it's really important. In terms of what the priority, the order of things, because I think of the path towards getting everybody that wants to be vaccinated is really ramping it up in an orderly way where we say the people that should be first and here's why, the people that should be next. What's the order in your mind of the groups that it's really important to get vaccinated?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first step is the frontline workers, the healthcare workers, and also EMS and those people that are really out and even more exposed than the year, quite honestly. If you think about it, in January of 2021, I feel relatively safe in the hospital as a healthcare worker. But if you're a squad, an EMS squad, you know, director out there walking into a home where people are not following masks or these kind of things, I mean, those are high-risk individuals. After that, I do agree with the order of structure of adding next the high-risk, the aged, the nursing home facilities, skilled nursing facilities, all those places are critical. And as a sidebar, it's been a horrible tragedy, not only the deaths there, but the isolation that all these patients have had from their families for this entire year. So the sooner we can get that back, the better it will be for these patients and their quality of life that are living in these types of facilities. And then I think we just go by age and risk factors going forward. But an important caveat, and I heard the Surgeon General say this, It doesn't mean that we can't continue to do mass vaccination. It's not like an airline where if you're a first-class ticket and supposed to go on first, if you don't show up, we're going to let somebody else on the plane next. So in the same way, I do believe, as the Surgeon General said, you know, we need to continue to, you know, we're not going to wait until every old person over age of 65 is vaccinated before we go to the next phase. And I think that would be a mistake. I think we have to really kind of develop as rapidly as we can process to get everyone vaccinated.
I so agree with that. I knew you were going to be great, Chairman Pompili, and you were. Thank you for a really important program. I know you helped a lot of people, and you actually helped a lot of people overcome maybe some objections that they just had because they didn't know any better. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise, and I hope we do this again sometime.
All right, Harry. Thank you so much. Take care. Have a great day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You too. What a great guest. What a great person.